Well, hello and welcome. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable every Saturday afternoon on Premier Christian Radio. You can find us, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking, debating and discussing every Saturday afternoon, as well as online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And there are plenty more resources there besides if you want to look into them. You can find things like the Unbelievable Conference DVD from May this year, and a host of great speakers were involved on that, including Professor John Lennox, David Robertson, and others besides apologists, talking about the claims of Christianity and offering answers to some of the tough questions about the Christian faith. So if you want to check that out, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and you can follow the link through to the DVD. But today, this is a special podcast edition only of the show. There is a radio edition of what you'll hear today going out, but that is in abbreviated form. Today you're hearing the entire event that took place at the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford. William Lane Craig was speaking there at the penultimate event of the Reasonable Faith Tour here in the UK, and his lecture title was Is God a Delusion? And he offers critiques of Richard Dawkins' book The God Delusion. And Richard Dawkins had been invited to come along and defend his book, The God Delusion. In fact, an empty chair was awaiting him just in case he decided to change his mind right up to the last minute. Well, that didn't happen, and he didn't change his mind. And the empty chair remained on stage, though, while Professor Craig delivered his talk. And then we heard from a panel of Oxford academics who responded to Bill's talk, and they had a very engaging conversation on the back of that. Chairing the whole event was Professor Peter Millikan, himself an atheist, but he had a really engaging and sort of collegial discussion and debate with Bill at the Birmingham event the week before, and had agreed to come, in fact volunteered himself to chair this event at the Sheldonian Theatre. Outside, there were interesting things going on. Protesters who were handing out a recent article from the Guardian website by Richard Dawkins, in which he made various allegations against William Lane Craig as to his credibility and his apparent justification of genocide in the Old Testament. Well, as you'll hear in the course of the event, a question was put to Bill on that very subject, and Bill answers that towards the end of the programme today. So listen out for that a little later on. If you'd like any more information on Unbelievable, as I say, the website is premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you want to get in touch, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk with your thoughts on the events that you're going to hear now. And indeed, if you'd like to stay in touch via our Facebook or Twitter feeds, then do check those out as well. You can find links to that from the website, but if you go straight to Facebook, you'll find us at facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Or indeed at Twitter, @UnbelievableJB. So I look forward to interacting via those platforms. In the meantime, it's time to hand over now for this entire recording of the event at the Oxford Sheldonian Theatre in front of another capacity crowd. Over 800 people gathered there and filled the Sheldonian Theatre to the brim to hear William Lane Craig deliver his critique of Dawkins' The God Delusion.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Good evening, and can I warmly welcome you to the Sheldonian Theatre this evening for the talk that we're just about to hear, Is God a Delusion? My name's Robbie Strachan. I'm the president of the Christian Union here at Oxford University. And it is a delight to be joined this evening by William Lane Craig, who will just be in a moment giving a lecture in response to Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. Now, it would have been great to be able to welcome Professor Richard Dawkins here this evening for public debate. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to make it. It is instead a great privilege to be joined by Professor Peter Millikan, who is the Gilbert Ryle Fellow and Professor of Philosophy at Hertford College, Oxford. He's going to be chairing the evening, and I really hope that you enjoy the evening this evening.
Thank you very much.
It's a real pleasure to welcome William Lane Craig to talk to us tonight. For the last 15 years, he's been research professor of philosophy at the Talbot School of Theology in La Mirada, California. He's the author of over 30 books and over 100 peer-reviewed articles in philosophy and theology. I'm just going to mention a couple of those books. The Cosmological Argument from Plato to Leibniz, that's actually my own copy, dated 1980. I got it when studying the BPhil here, studying philosophy of religion under Basil Mitchell. And it was clear even then that Bill's book was a new landmark in discussion of the cosmological argument. More recently, 2009, one of his latest contributions is the monumental Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, which he jointly edited, no less than 700 pages and a snip at £125. Another book I'll particularly mention is this one, God, A Debate Between a Christian and an Atheist, jointly done with Walter Sinnott Armstrong. It grew out of a debate they did together, and I think I can't think of a better book to recommend if you want to see the theist and atheist points of view put robustly, but with respect and a very energetic argument. Bill has a particular connection with Britain. He actually did his PhD in philosophy under John Hick at the University of Birmingham back in 1977.
Yes.
Birmingham actually is where I debated with Bill on Friday, and we had a spirited debate. So I'm in the other camp, but you won't be hearing much from me tonight apart from directing proceedings. If you want to know what I think about these things, I think our debate is soon to appear on the web. After doing the PhD in philosophy, Bill also took a doctorate in theology under the celebrated theologian Wolfhart Pannenberg at Munich. So he's extremely well prepared on both sides. In my debate on Friday, I realised what it's like dealing with such an extremely well prepared opponent, where it's very hard to come up with things that he hasn't heard before and thought through. It will be very interesting tonight to hear what he has to say on Richard Dawkins' arguments. The pattern for tonight will be that Bill will be speaking for 45 or 50 minutes. We then have three Oxford academics who have kindly offered to come representing a range of views to comment on what Bill has to say. Bill is then going to be given a chance to respond to them, and then we'll have a short break. Now, cards have been given out to the audience. If you haven't got one, then in that break, please feel free to ask one of the ushers for one. On those cards, you are welcome to write questions. Also, you're welcome to tell us to whom you would like the question to be addressed. Our three speakers are Daniel Kame, Stephen Priest, and John Parrington, and I'll be saying a little bit more about them in turn when we introduce them. But if one of them, as well as Bill, says something to which you'd like to respond, feel free to do so. Those questions will come to me during the break, and then I shall try to sort through them and pick ones that are particularly representative of the questions that have been asked and give our speakers a chance to respond to them. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over to William Lane Craig on the subject, Is God a Delusion? Thank you.
Thank you very much. It is a privilege to be here with you this evening and speaking in such an august setting as this. During the years that Jan and I lived in England while I was doing my doctoral studies at the University of Birmingham, we grew to have a deep affection for this country and for people, and so it is truly a joy and a delight for us to be back in the UK and to be participating in this speaking tour, including the event tonight. A couple years ago, I published an article in which I described the renaissance among contemporary philosophers concerning arguments for the existence of God. And it was fascinating to read the discussion in the blogosphere in response to this article. Along with expressions of appreciation, there were also comments like the following. Dawkins' The God Delusion soundly deals with these arguments. Did you even do any research? Or again, have you even read Dawkins' book? He answers every one of those arguments quite well. Or again, I was dismayed that Dr. Craig has used these arguments to defend the existence of God. As someone mentioned before, has he even read Dawkins' book? Well, what is remarkable about these comments is the degree of confidence placed in Richard Dawkins' supposed refutation of the arguments for God's existence. Are they right? Has Richard Dawkins dealt the death blow to these theistic arguments that I discussed? Well, I propose this evening to look at those arguments and see what Dawkins has to say about each one. Now, since our time is very limited tonight, I can consider only the objections that Richard Dawkins himself raises. Doubtless you can think of other objections. For a fuller treatment, I would refer you to my book, Reasonable Faith, or the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology. To begin with, then, the cosmological argument. Dawkins doesn't even discuss the first form of the cosmological argument, which I mentioned in my article, namely the argument from contingency. Now, this is a remarkable oversight since it's the most famous version of the cosmological argument. Indeed, it would be deserving to be called the standard form of the cosmological argument. So, obviously, it isn't the case that Richard Dawkins has refuted all the arguments that I surveyed in my article. But Dawkins does discuss a different type of cosmological argument, which may be formulated as follows. Premise one, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Two, the universe began to exist. Three, therefore, the universe has a cause. Once we reach the conclusion that the universe has a cause, we can analyze what properties such a cause must have. Now, premise one, that everything that begins to exist has a cause, seems obviously true, at least more so than its negation. To suggest that things could just pop into being, uncaused, out of nothing, is to quit doing serious metaphysics and to resort to magic. Premise two, that the universe began to exist, can be supported by both philosophical argument and scientific evidence. The philosophical arguments aim to show that there cannot have been an infinite regress of past events, or in other words, that the series of past events must have had a beginning. The philosophical arguments against an infinite regress of events are fascinating and mind-expanding, but we needn't consider them this evening since Dawkins doesn't object to any of these arguments. The scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe is based on the expansion of the universe. We now have pretty strong evidence that the universe is not eternal in the past, but had an absolute beginning a finite time ago. In 2003, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin were able to prove that any universe which has on average been in a state of cosmic expansion throughout its history cannot be infinite in the past, but must have a past space-time boundary. Even if our universe is just a tiny part of a so-called multiverse composed of many universes, their theorem requires that the multiverse itself must have an absolute beginning. Of course, highly speculative scenarios, such as loop quantum gravity models, string models, even closed time-like curves have been proposed to try to avoid this absolute beginning. Although these models are all fraught with problems, the bottom line is that none of these theories, even if true, succeeds in restoring an eternal past. At most, they just push the beginning back a step. Vilenkin pulls no punches. He writes, "It is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning," end quote. Now, it follows from the two premises of the argument that therefore the universe has a cause. What properties must the cause of the universe possess? Well, by the very nature of the case, as the cause of space and time, this entity must transcend space and time and therefore exist non-temporally and non-spatially, at least without the universe. This transcendent cause must also, therefore, be changeless and immaterial, since anything that is timeless must be unchanging, and anything that is changeless must be non-physical and immaterial, since material things are constantly changing on at least the molecular and atomic levels. Such a cause must be beginningless and uncaused, at least in the sense of lacking any prior causal conditions, since there cannot be an infinite regress of causes. Occam's razor, the principle that says we should not multiply causes beyond necessity, will shave away any further causes, since only one cause is required to explain the effect. This entity must be unimaginably powerful, if not omnipotent, since it created the universe without any material cause. Finally, and most remarkably, such a transcendent first cause is plausibly personal. Two reasons can be given for this conclusion. First, the personhood of the first cause of the universe is implied by its timelessness and immateriality. The only entities which can possess such properties are either unembodied minds or abstract objects like numbers. But abstract objects don't stand in causal relations. The number 7, for example, can't cause anything. Therefore, it follows logically that the transcendent cause of the origin of the universe is an unembodied mind or consciousness. Second, this same conclusion is also implied by the origin of an effect with a beginning from a beginningless cause. We've concluded that the beginning of the universe was the effect of a first cause. By the nature of the case, that cause cannot have either a beginning of its existence or any prior cause. It just exists changelessly, without beginning. And a finite time ago, it brought the universe into existence. Now, this is exceedingly odd. The cause is in some sense eternal, and yet the effect which it produced is not eternal, but began to exist a finite time ago. How can this be? If the necessary and sufficient conditions for the effect are eternal, then why isn't the effect also eternal? How can the cause exist without the effect? There seems to be only one way out of this dilemma, and that is to say that the cause of the universe's beginning is a personal agent endowed with free will who freely chooses to create a universe in time. Philosophers call this type of causation agent causation. And because the agent is free, he can spontaneously initiate new effects by freely bringing about conditions which were not previously present. And thus a finite time ago, a creator endowed with free will could have freely brought the world into being at that moment. In this way, the creator could exist changelessly and eternally, but freely create the universe in time. By exercising his causal power, he brings it about that a world with a beginning comes to exist. So the cause can be eternal, but the effect is not. In this way, then, it seems that it's possible for a temporal universe to have come into being from an eternal cause through the free will of a personal creator. We may therefore conclude that a personal creator of the universe exists, who is uncaused, beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and unimaginably powerful. Now, Dawkins does, as I say, address this version of the cosmological argument. Remarkably, however, he doesn't dispute either premise of the argument. Instead, he merely questions the theological significance of the argument's conclusion. He writes, and I quote, "Even if we allow the dubious luxury of arbitrarily conjuring up a terminator to an infinite regress and giving it a name, there is absolutely no reason to endow that terminator with any of the properties normally ascribed to God: omnipotence, omniscience, goodness, creativity of design, to say nothing of such human qualities as listening to prayers, forgiving sins, and reading innermost thoughts." Now, apart from the opening slur, this is a remarkably concessionary statement. Dawkins doesn't dispute that the argument proves the existence of an uncaused, beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and unimaginably powerful personal creator of the universe. He merely complains that this cause hasn't also been shown to be omnipotent, omniscient, good, creative of design, listening to prayers, forgiving sins, and reading innermost thoughts. So what? The argument was never intended to prove such things. It would be a bizarre form of atheism, indeed one not worth the name, which admitted that there exists an uncaused, beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and unimaginably powerful personal creator of the universe, who may, for all we know, also possess the further properties listed by Dawkins. We needn't call the personal creator of the universe God if Dawkins finds this unhelpful or misleading, but the point remains that such a being as is here described must exist. Secondly, the moral argument. Here's a simple moral argument for God's existence. Premise one, if God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. Two, objective moral values and duties do exist. Three, therefore, God exists. What makes this little argument so powerful is not only that it's logically ironclad, but also that people generally believe both premises. In fact, Dawkins himself seems to be committed to the truth of both premises. With respect to premise one, that if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist, Dawkins informs us, and I quote, "There is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for being," end quote. But although he says that there is no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference, the fact is that Richard Dawkins is a stubborn moralist. He vigorously condemns such actions as the harassment and abuse of homosexuals, the religious indoctrination of children, the Incan practice of human sacrifice, and prizing cultural diversity over the interests of Amish children. He even goes so far as to offer his own amended Ten Commandments for guiding moral behavior, all the while marvelously oblivious to the contradiction with his ethical subjectivism. Thus, affirming both premises of the moral argument, Dawkins is, on pain of irrationality, committed to the argument's conclusion, namely, that God exists. Thirdly, the teleological argument. The cutting edge of contemporary discussion of the teleological or design argument concerns the remarkable fine-tuning of the cosmos for life. Dawkins responds to this form of the argument in chapter 4 of his book under the heading The Anthropic Principle Cosmological Version. Here's a simple formulation of a teleological argument based on fine-tuning. Premise 1, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Premise 2, it is not due to physical necessity or chance. 3, therefore, it is due to design. Now, with respect to premise 1, I'd better explain what is meant by fine-tuning. This expression does not mean designed. Otherwise, the argument would be obviously circular. Rather, during the last 40 years or so, scientists have discovered that the existence of intelligent life depends upon a complex and delicate balance of initial conditions given in the Big Bang itself. Were nature's fundamental constants and quantities to be altered by less than a hair's breadth, the life-permitting balance would be destroyed and no living interactive organisms could exist. Dawkins himself, citing the work of the Astronomer Royal, Sir Martin Rees, acknowledges that the universe does exhibit this remarkable fine-tuning. Now, premise one, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design, simply lists the three possibilities for explaining the presence of this amazing fine-tuning of the universe. The question is, which of these alternatives is the most plausible? Premise two addresses that question. The first alternative, physical necessity, is extraordinarily implausible because the constants and the quantities are independent of the laws of nature. The laws of nature are consistent with a wide range of values for these constants and quantities. So, for example, the most promising candidate for a theory of everything to date, M-theory or superstring theory, allows for a cosmic landscape of around 10 to the 500th power different possible universes governed by the present laws of nature. Dawkins notes that Sir Martin Rees rejects this first alternative, physical necessity, and Dawkins adds his own comment, "I think I agree." So, what about the second alternative, that the fine-tuning of the universe is due to chance? The problem with this alternative is that the odds against the universe's being life-permitting are so incomprehensibly great that they cannot be reasonably faced. In order to rescue the alternative of chance, therefore, its proponents have been forced to adopt the remarkable hypothesis that there exists an infinite number of randomly ordered universes composing a sort of world ensemble or multiverse of which our universe is but a part. Somewhere in this infinite ensemble, finely tuned universes will appear by chance alone. And we happen to be in one such world. This is the explanation that Richard Dawkins finds most plausible. Now, Dawkins is acutely sensitive to the charge that postulating a world ensemble of randomly ordered universes seems to be what he calls an unparsimonious extravagance. But, he retorts, and I quote, "The multiverse may seem extravagant in sheer number of universes, but if each one of those universes is simple in its fundamental laws, we are still not postulating anything highly improbable," end quote. Unfortunately, this response is multiply confused. First, each universe in the ensemble is not simple, but is characterized by a multiplicity of constants and quantities. If each universe were simple, then why did Dawkins feel the need to recur to the hypothesis of a world ensemble in the first place? Second, Dawkins assumes that the simplicity of the whole is a function of the simplicity of the parts. But this is an obvious mistake. A complex mosaic, for example, is made up of a great number of individually simple parts. In the same way, an ensemble of simple universes will still be complex if those universes are randomly ordered in the values of their fundamental constants and quantities, rather than all sharing the same values. Third, Occam's razor tells us not to multiply entities beyond necessity, so that the number of universes being postulated simply to explain the fine-tuning is, at face value, extravagant. Appealing to a world ensemble to explain fine-tuning is like using a sledgehammer to crack a peanut. Fourth, Dawkins tries to minimize the extravagance of the postulate of a world ensemble by claiming that despite its extravagant number of entities, still, such a postulate is not highly improbable. But it's not clear why this rejoinder is relevant or even what it means. The objection under consideration is not that the postulate of a world ensemble is improbable, but that it's extravagant and unparsimonious. To say that the postulate isn't also improbable is to fail to address the objection. Indeed, it's hard to know what probability Dawkins is talking about here. He seems to mean the intrinsic probability of the postulate of a world ensemble considered apart from the evidence of fine-tuning. But how is such a probability to be determined? By simplicity? But then Dawkins hasn't shown the world ensemble hypothesis to be simple. What Dawkins needs to say, it seems to me, if I might offer a suggestion, is that the postulate of an ensemble of universes may still be simple if there is a simple mechanism which, through a repetitive process, generates the many worlds. In that way, the huge number of entities postulated is not a deficit of the theory, because the entities all issue from a very simple fundamental mechanism. So, what mechanisms does Dawkins propose for generating such an infinite, randomly ordered world ensemble? Well, he suggests two. First, he suggests an oscillating model of the universe, according to which the universe has gone through an infinite series of expansions and contractions. Dawkins is, however, apparently unaware of the many difficulties of oscillatory models of the universe, which have made contemporary cosmologists quite skeptical of them. Such models contradict the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorems. The evidence of observational astronomy has been consistently against the hypothesis that the universe will someday recontract, and the thermodynamic properties of such models imply the very beginning of the universe that their proponents sought to avoid. But leave all that aside. Even if the universe could oscillate from eternity past, ironically, such a universe would require an infinitely precise fine-tuning of initial conditions in order to persist through an infinite series of expansions and contractions, so that the mechanism that Dawkins postulates for generating as many worlds is not simple. In fact, quite the opposite. It requires infinite fine-tuning. Moreover, such a universe involves fine-tuning of a very bizarre sort, because the initial conditions have to be set at minus infinity in the past. But how can that be done if there was no beginning? Dawkins' second suggested mechanism for generating a world ensemble is Lee Smolin's evolutionary cosmology, according to which black holes are portals to baby universes being birthed by our universe. Universes which produce lots of black holes therefore have an evolutionary advantage in producing more offspring. Now, since black holes are the result of star formation, and stars favor planets where life can evolve, the unintended effect of evolutionary cosmology is to make life-permitting universes more probable. Dawkins acknowledges that not all physicists are enthusiastic about Smolin's scenario. Talk about an understatement. For Smolin's scenario, wholly apart from its ad hoc and even disconfirmed conjectures, encountered insuperable difficulties. First, a fatal flaw in Smolin's scenario was his assumption that universes which produce lots of black holes would also produce lots of stable stars. In fact, the exact opposite is true. The most proficient producers of black holes would be universes which generate primordial black holes prior to star formation, so that life-permitting universes would actually be weeded out by Smolin's evolutionary scenario. Thus, it turns out that Smolin's scenario would actually make the existence of a life-permitting universe even more improbable. Second, speculations about the universes begetting baby universes via black holes seems to contradict quantum physics. The conjecture that black holes may be portals of wormholes through which bubbles of vacuum energy can tunnel to spawn new expanding baby universes was the subject of a bet between Stephen Hawking and John Preskill, which Hawking finally admitted in 2004 that he had lost. The conjecture would require that the information which is locked up in a black hole could be utterly lost forever by escaping to another universe. One of the last holdouts, Hawking finally came to agree that quantum theory requires that information is preserved in black hole formation and evaporation. The implications? Hawking writes, "There is no baby universe branching off as I once thought. The information remains firmly in our universe. I'm sorry to disappoint science fiction fans, but if information is preserved, there is no possibility of using black holes to travel to other universes," end quote. Now, if this result is correct, then Smolin's scenario is literally physically impossible. These are